Five, four, three, two, one. Hello and welcome to Life in the Foam. This is the podcast for the 21st century world of private media bubbles. Everyone can shape their own environment today, program it to be whatever they want, get their own solipsistic personal view on the world. This is very much different than the media world of the 20th century. Joining us today, I'm happy to welcome Andrew McLuhan, the founder of the new McLuhan Institute based in Picton, Ontario. Welcome to the show, Andrew.
Thanks, Clinton. Happy to be here.
Thanks. Coming at you 300 kilometers away from Ottawa, Ontario, joined by the miracle of technology here. Right? Now I hear that's a little bit of your expertise in running in the family.
What's that? I'm the student of the student, so three perks removed, but I'm trying to keep up.
Well, as you said before, crowdsourcing discovery of the ground of our new medium is essential. Where are you right now?
So I'm coming at you from a place we call the Scriptorium, which is my dad's old office here in Prince Edward County. Just giving you the walking tour here. That's his old desk behind me. I thought instead of sitting behind his desk and using his computer, I'd do it on mobile. So we could look around and do the peripatetic thing, you know, the walking philosopher, although I don't consider myself a philosopher. This is the place where my dad did all his work, writing, exploration. God knows what he got up to in here, building model airplanes. For the last dozen years or so, he passed away last May. And now it's sort of the temporary headquarters of what I've called the McLuhan Institute. And that's something I started working on summer of 2017 when I realized that my dad, Eric, wasn't going to be around forever, and there was nothing in place to keep going once he passed. So, I mean, I guess I saw that coming. I didn't think it would happen less than a year later, but that's the way things go. And I'm glad I at least got a start on it. So, I've built a following on Facebook of about 700 people, and I'm on Instagram and Twitter. And basically, the McLuhan Institute exists for a fourfold purpose: research, education, archive, exploration. Kind of out of order, but it rhymes nicely. The archive bit is a lot of what I'm showing you right here. All the collected works of Marshall McLuhan and Eric McLuhan. We have files and copies of most of what's in the National Archives in Ottawa. And behind me here is Eric McLuhan's 6,000 plus library, annotated library, which I'm in the process of documenting and inventorying, much as I did for Marshall's library back in 2010. Marshall's library is now at the Fisher Rare Book Library in Toronto. And at least for the time being, Eric McLuhan's library is here with me in this building. So that's the archive portion, research, exploration. So what's really interesting to me, I started the McLuhan Institute for the reason I stated, but also because, I was about to turn 40. And I'd been following my dad around for years, you know, carrying his books, as it were, his lecture notes when he traveled, and getting more and more interested in the work. But I had to ask myself, you know, what's the point of it? And if I'm going to do anything with it, what would I want to do? And what I find interesting or useful in McLuhan work is the tools, the practical tools that we can extract from it, in order to understand our situation today and going forward, our situations tomorrow. that to me is the use of it, because it's great to look at what Marshall did back in the 60s and even the 50s and even the 40s and what even my dad did in the last decades. But, you know, that's sort of historical record. And while it may be interesting, and it is very interesting, I don't think it has much relevance to what we're doing or what we're doing tomorrow, or understanding our present, unless we can extract from it practical tools to be able to help us. So that really is, in education and research, my primary goal here is extracting tools like Figure and Ground in the Tetrad and others for the training of perception and awareness, and hopefully getting a handle on where we are. And I have to say, I'm not an expert on any of it. I'm maybe an advanced student because I've been doing it for a while, but there's way more that I don't know than I do know. But what I do have is all these amazing resources at my fingertips and a pretty good idea of how to get around them. And I found that, you know, even somebody who's not so academically inclined as myself, with a bit of work and effort, can get the hang of it, but it does take a lot of work. It's not the casual reading, you know, as I'm sure you've found, Quentin.
Right. Oh, absolutely. No, it goes from a mind expanding to mind blowing to having to reread the same paragraph 6 times, slower and slower each time, to try to figure out what you just read. At least when it comes to it.
Yeah, and you know, everybody has to do that, and it takes a certain amount of, I think, humility to be able to do it. I've read the first couple paragraphs of Understanding Media time and time and time and time again, and I don't think I'll ever stop reading that book. You know, you get to the end and you start again, because it's so deep, so layered. And I'm not sure a lot of people aren't used to reading that way. People are used to reading things one time through, maybe twice, and getting it. And you have to humble yourself a little bit, let go a bit of your ego to really encounter something like that on its terms, because you know, Marshall was an English professor. He had an amazing vocabulary, and he always used words intentionally and never casually. He was also really big on puns, on multi-layered meanings. So you know, a lot of his work holds up to multiple readings and in fact demands it. So don't feel bad about having to read things again and again. I don't think it's a sign of anyone's failing. And Marshall has faced this criticism, but I don't think it's a failing of his that he's not able to communicate or that he's a terrible writer. I think it's quite the opposite. It's just that people aren't used to reading like that.
Am I close to the mark when I posit that it seems like what Marshall McLuhan did was take a book as utterly unreadable as Finnegan's Wake, which is so chaotic and dense with possible interpretations. It's right. James Joyce used a method of just stringing together a sentence that could have 27 possible interpretations. Right, the way his mind used the sound of words in an oral sense compared to the written sense, that Marshall McLuhan seems to have just grown on that technique and sort of was able to create something also very multi-layered. And that's why his writings kind of present something new every time you read them, so to speak.
Yeah, well, I mean, James Joyce in Finnegan's Wake took it 100 steps further than Marshall ever did. You know, James Joyce in Finnegan's Wake, he has these 10 thunders. And again, I'm not an expert in the Wake. My dad wrote his thesis on these 10 words in Finnegan's Wake. And they're 100 letters long, and they're a mishmash of dozens and dozens of languages which document 10 major technologies. This is not an easy book to read. One of the keys to reading Finnegan's Wake is to read it aloud. And it is meant to be read aloud so that you hear the words and you hear the multiple levels. My dad told me that Finnegan's Wake is a manual for training perception. And one of my ideas for the McLuhan Institute in the courses I'd like to offer is a Finnegan's Wake reading course. And all it really is the class reading Finnegan's Wake out loud to each other every day. And you take turns reading. Everybody has to read it. And that's it. You basically can start anywhere. You don't have to get through the whole book. When you read something like that, when you really dive into it and spend time with it, it changes you. It does train your perception because you start to look at words as not having meanings, but multiple levels of meaning. So you'll find yourself encountering words in different ways and I think living poetically, which is a great thing. Or not, depending on
so for on instance, how much you like if you language. Think of the New York Times, and you see, you know, all the news that's fit to print in the upper corner. You can find what does that mean, right? If you really meditate on it, I think that was one of the examples.
Sure. Yep. Yeah, and wordplay too. I do a daily exercise in writing poetry now. I don't know if you've caught that on Facebook, but I stop and I take a picture in the same place every day on my way into work here. And I've come to the habit of writing some words to go with it. And it's really made a difference in my life, actually. I'm feeling the benefits of poetry because, you know, everything is everything. And it leaks, you know, poetry. If you practice poetry, if you read poetry, it affects everything else that you do, which is, can drive other people crazy, but I find it very helpful to me. It makes my other writing a lot more interesting and easy.
Mm-hmm. Well, when meaning flows in multiple levels, which is something which electric media tends to bring out of us, having come from a more book-based society for the past couple hundred years. At least that's sort of what I'm trying to bridge insofar as what's going on today, where people not only are creating meaning in multiple levels, but they can also sequester or narrow themselves down intensely on one focus because people... Right? So I was wondering... what are your thoughts on media ecology in the 21st century, or what were Eric McLuhan's thoughts on media ecology in the 21st century, where we have these, where the audience is so much more involved in programming their environment?
Yeah, well, of course, media ecology in the 21st century is the title of my dad's last speech, which I'm sure you're aware of, which is, has now been published. It will be available. I'm not sure how widely it's going to be available, but I'm trying pretty hard to get the recording of it released so I can put it up on the McLuhan Institute's YouTube page, but they're kind of dragging their heels for some reason. I don't know. Mm-hmm. It'll come eventually. My dad was very optimistic for the field of media ecology. Especially outside the North American context, because even though it's still a very young field, it's really conservative, and it shouldn't be. It should be the opposite of conservative. This was one of the things that Marshall ran up against. He drew upon every field for the study of media because, you know, everything is media. He had the broadest terms possible for what he considered media or technology. You know, when people talk about media or technology today, most people think about, cell phones, computers. They might even go so far as telephone, radio, television. But it's harder for them at least unless you suggest it, they wouldn't think of it, to consider something like speech itself, you know, as a technology. But Marshall did. His definition of technology was basically any human innovation. And that could be anything from an object to a style, you know, a type of fashion, a kind of music. All these innovations reveal things about our humanity and come from our humanity. And I think academia likes to harden things into categories. Not that I have, you know, over contempt for academia, but not being an academic myself. I think the future of the field of media ecology is not in academia, but outside it. And I think that because there's not a lot of freedom inside academia. And in order to pursue the study of an environment or environments plural, you really need to look at a total situation. It is a total situation. So you need to be able to step outside any little boundaries like a media studies department or an English department or whatever department. And early on, Marshall earned a lot of hatred is a strong word. Some people didn't care for him. But back in the 20th century, you know, in the early 20th century, mid-20th, even late 20th century, the idea of interdisciplinary studies was not really a thing. You were supposed to specialize and stay in your lane, you know, and you weren't, you were seen as an interloper or, you know, stepping on toes if you wanted to go into somebody else's specialty. But of course, in order to do what Marshall did, he had to draw on all the fields. So, for instance, Harold Innes in economics, who was a big inspiration for Marshall's work. You know, he went into art, he went into economics, he went into psychology, he went everywhere and didn't get a lot of thanks for it. But that's sort of the roots of interdisciplinary study, which is a lot more common today, but even today it's not as free. The advantage for people like you and I, and possibly your viewers or listeners, being not inside academia, is we don't have anybody telling us not to go there, you know? So we can go anywhere.
Well, yes.
And one of the things Dad appreciated about delivering his speech, this speech in particular, in Colombia at the Universidad de la Sabana in Bogota, he felt they had a really good shot at things because they were just starting a PhD program in media study. That meant that they had an opportunity to do things differently. They weren't caught up with, you know, the established North American or even European schools. And I think he tried in his speech very hard to press home that point that they had a real opportunity here to, as he called it, leapfrog and skip a lot of the hurdles that other people are caught up in.
Yeah, I think Marshall McLuhan said Canada didn't have a 19th century, and California didn't have a 19th
right.
century, and so they didn't have to slog through it. They could start fresh, sort of thing.
Exactly, same idea.
Mm-hmm. Right, that makes a lot of sense, absolutely. Interesting. How having gone through the 20th century as a leader in technology, you might look at America or most Western developed countries as having been clouded by this slow slog through developing the technologies fresh. That brings me to a question. I'm not sure if you have any thoughts on after McLuhan. I mean, it seems that the trend in academia, since we're talking about it, where you say McLuhan caught a lot of flack, is... I mean, he ends up being criticized or analyzed by following postmodernists who would never apply his, you know, broad field analysis of techniques. They're right, like you got people like again, I'm a dilettante myself. I'm going to step on a lot of toes straying out of my lane here, but, I mean, as far as I understand it, you got, like, thinkers like Jacques Derrida who question, you know, well, text isn't, you know, doesn't come after the spoken word. The two of them are at the same distancing level that keep, right, all these theories which don't build on McLuhan, but rather criticize him, try to encapsulate him, or cut him up in a... misunderstand. Like, has postmodernism or has academia after McLuhan misunderstood McLuhan or thrown him out needlessly, or is there much justice there from what you know based on people who study a broader critical theory in academia?
Right. It's hard for me to address a lot of that because I haven't studied or any of those people really. And that's one of the advantages of going to university is that you get a really good broad education there. But that hasn't really been one of my big interests. I've been focusing on, you know, it's ironic to be a McLuhan specialist, right? But I guess that's what I am. And frankly, I haven't even gotten through all of McLuhan's stuff one time around. There's just so much. It's crazy. Perhaps when I've got another decade under my belt, I'll be able to look around more. But I think I already kind of answered your question a little bit. But I'll say it again in that... getting a handle on McLuhan's work is very difficult, and it requires doing a lot more work than I think people are comfortable or want to do, mm-hmm. because there's a lot to it. It's more than simply, you know, the aphorisms. You know, it's literary criticism, it's English studies. And it's a whole program that I'm not sure you can pick and choose items and try and isolate. Maybe I'm wrong about that.
Well,
but,
is it? Does it ultimately is the ultimate goal to lead to a form of perception that you can then bring to the world at present? Now you have to take what you've learned to look around and now report on. The environment that we're living in. I guess that's been my takeaway from the preparation that studying McLuhan brings you for.
Yeah, I'd say you're spot on. And you know, I mean, people are welcome to take bits and pieces that they find useful and using your work. Like, I wouldn't expect anybody to do what I'm doing and, you know, basically dedicate your life to try and get a handle on all this work. It's kind of a fool's errand. And, you know, maybe I'm going to contradict myself now by saying I don't think it is actually necessary because the way I see McLuhan's work, and, you know, I've got a whole bunch of it behind me right now, possibly because in my career I work as an upholsterer and a restorer of furniture. I'm in a workshop, and that's next door here in the other barn. And I'm surrounded by tools every day. And that's how I look at the McLuhan work, as a workshop full of tools. And finding the right tool for the job is critical and can save you a lot of time. So there are definitely ways in that require somebody to dedicate their whole life. Just like figure and ground. You know, that's one simple tool that can actually go a long way.
I think there's something very grounding about the mellow of a workshop. I mean, I grew up, my father had a huge workshop. He's an avionics technician, but he also works with his hands repairing stuff. When I have conversations with electricians, tradespeople, or basically anybody who works in the trades, I always find them, they have a perception for how, you know, the building is built and how square that corner is or what is, right? They've got an eye for detail that lots of people lack for being grounded in the physical. I had to make it, the experience of working with tools really puts you in the material world. So as an upholsterer, I assume you've got an eye for furniture That's probably, you're probably pointing things out to people all the time about.
Well, exactly. It's a kind of thing that I can't just go into somebody's house and sit on their furniture without evaluating it. You know, it's a structural thing.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I know what's happening underneath the surface, you know, in that ground, mm-hmm. as it were. And that's the same way with other trades. And it's also why I feel an affinity with trades, because, you know, there's not a ton of room for theory, you know, in the plumbing business.
People, you know, it's all hurt if you don't do it right, or, you know.
Right? You know, avionics, I mean, sure, theory applies, but when it comes down to it, it's what you can use.
Mm-hmm.
I suppose some theory is useful for, you know, getting a handle on things, but when it comes down to it, it's about tools.
Buckminster Fuller has this phrase he uses at near the start of his book Spaceship Earth. I read it and it struck with me, and it's how it's non-sensorially tunable aspects of reality. So he basically says once electricity came in and radio waves came in, pirates stopped being kings of the seas because all these technologies like radar and radio waves, you know, which are not, you can't see them. They're beyond, right, as soon as humans started making things you can't see, using technology, now people can't rely anymore on their raw senses of seeing the world as we evolved. Right, we break out of the human frame, and now there's parts of the world like germs on your table until Pasteur you know, told us, hey, you better wash your hands. What? I can't see anything. All right, there's these huge leaps in human evolution that happen when we start having to learn these things which aren't abstract, but we have to treat them as abstract because we can't see them, right? Like, that's what electricity is,
yeah.
Even, you know?
Yeah, Marshall has a quote about that. He says I think it's from Understanding Media, I'm in the position of Louis Pasteur trying to tell people that, you know, what ails them is all around them, but you just can't see it.
Mm-hmm.
He also had one about, you know, I'm in here trying to tell everybody that the place is on fire, and people think that because you pulled the alarm, it means you started the fire. And, you know, that's not the case. He talked a lot about that, you know, people think that if you talk about something, you're in favor of it. But in my case, almost everything I talk about is not something I'm in favor of. You know, he was really actually a very conservative guy. He just wanted to be left alone.
Well, that's not possible anymore, is it? So
not very easily, no.
Not very easily, yeah. Oh, man. Oh, that's interesting. You're a projectionist. You work at the local theater down there in Picton.
Yeah. I got a job at the local theater, the Regent Theater in Picton, something like 8 years ago. I wanted to see, it's really funny this is coming up, but I'm a big fan of street art, of Banksy. Street art because street artists are people who play with the ground, and they turn ground into figure. And one of the things I enjoy most about street art is, and a street artist is constantly looking at the environment around them and looking for ways to interact with it. And I see some street art in that way as pun, because it's multi-leveled. So Banksy has this one piece, which is a knockoff of the girl with the pearl earring. And he did it on this wall that has a big fire alarm on it. And he used the fire alarm as the pearl earring. So the street artist is constantly looking for things in the environment to pull out and to draw your attention to. And I find that very interesting. So when Banksy came out with his movie Exit Through the Gift Shop, I think it was 2008. Jeez. Anyway, I really wanted to see it, So I asked the guy in charge of the theater at the time if he was going to get it, and he said, well, you know, no, I don't think anybody will come see it, you know. And I said, well, yeah, for sure people will come see it, you know. It's Banksy. There's, you know, this is an art sort of community. He said, well, I don't know. I said, well, because he said, you know, it's not worth it for me if only a couple people come out. And I said, okay, well, you know, how many people have to come see a movie for it to be worth it? And he said, well, you know, 30, 35. I said, are you kidding? Like, I can get that many. I can get, you know, more than that. And he said, well, if you can do it, we'll show it. So I created an event and a poster, and I did a lot of hype and sold tickets, and ended up getting, I think, 235 people to come to the movie.
Nice.
And on the strength of that, he asked me if I wanted to be a projectionist. So I've been doing that ever since, and Wednesday nights I'm at the theater. When I started, I guess 10 years ago or so now, we were showing 35mm film. But, you know, for the last 4 years, I think, we're all digital now. And a movie that used to come in four or five cans and you had to splice them together, now comes on a hard drive and you download an encryption key and you build a playlist. And basically, I sell tickets, I hit play, and I kick back for an hour and a half and do some work, you know, which is kind of great. But and less stressful, because with film, you know, you had to be really on top, because if something happened, you had to shut down the projector, close the shutter so it doesn't start a fire, you know, and you had to stop the film, and you had film going all over the place, and you'd have to cut it and splice it and roll it back together, and it can be pretty stressful. So, you know, there are definite advantages to digital, but I do kind of miss the analog, mm-hmm. you know.
Well, yeah, it would be
the magic of it.
I guess that's the real world on a spool. Real R-E-E-L.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
The pun is always intentional.
Oh, that's awesome. So that's a pretty good venue. You've got a weekly art film to go see every week and get paid for it. That's an interesting domain to have your film.
It's not an art film, like. And Wednesday nights are pretty quiet. I've only ever had one night where nobody showed up, but two people came this past week to the movie, which, you know, doesn't nearly cover the costs in the theater. But it's a not-for-profit theater now, which is cool. And we don't get great movies. What was it? Akira, the warrior something or other, half animated movie. I don't even remember the film. I've been working on this. I recently discovered on the shelves here an obscure journal called Neurotica. Did you catch a little tidbit about that?
Yeah. I had read Time
which
Life
is
and,
it's amazing.
Oh. So I guess it's just this. Yeah, everyone should check out the McLuhan Institute YouTube video where you read the introduction. It's like this sort of magazine for subversive psychologists who want to work outside of psychology.
Basically, it's kind of. He talks about how the journal is dead, and you know, academia's messed up, so we're going to do it ourselves, and you know, talks a lot of shit about the kind of work being done, and then opens with this essay by Marshall called The Psychopathology of Time and Life, where it's basically a takedown of Time, Life, and Fortune magazines, and I think his name is Henry Luce, the publisher. And it's remarkable. I'm going to be putting it up on the McLuhanInstitute.com as soon as I figure out how to do that. I've got it all scanned and everything. But I'm working through the article in order to write a sort of essay on the essay to maybe make it a little more comprehensible. It's amazing because there are a few different. There are several different Marshall McLuhans, I'll even go so far as to say. You know, Marshall started his career as And he was, for his whole career, actually an English professor. He specialized in the moderns, in modernist poetry, and he taught it for his entire career. In his early part of his career, up to the mid-50s, and even into the 60s, he was primarily a literary critic, and he contributed to, you see them here, these are all scholarly journals, 70 Review, Renaissance, University of Toronto Quarterly, book reviews, literary criticism, and his style was a lot different from the Marshall that you know if you've seen him on television or on YouTube or whatever, or in magazine interviews from the 60s and 70s, where he was very conscious to not make value judgments or moral judgments of any kind. That's not the case in much of his early work, like The Mechanical Bride, his first book, which is a takedown of advertising. So this article, The Psychopathology of Time and Life, is really harsh on this guy Luce. Like, it's brutal, and I can see why Marshall never made the cover of Time magazine, because it's awful. I mean, it's a really cool article, and there's some neat bits. I did a post on the Marshall McLuhan Estate Facebook page of a really interesting paragraph near the end of it, where he talks about, and this is 1949, mind you, 70 years ago now, where he says that basically, if we don't unplug, we're screwed. Hmm. And he basically says it in those terms, which he wouldn't say anything like that later on. He'd be a lot more cagey and talk about how we can do certain things, or, you know, but he said it in such very strong and definite terms here. And it's very much the fashion right now to talk about taking breaks from social media and whatever else. And I always find it funny when somebody posts on Facebook, you know, just to let you all know I'm taking a break from Facebook if you don't see me around. And it's like, you know, you could just leave and not tell anybody, but that you're afraid that nobody will notice if you leave, right? Anyway, I'd encourage people listening or watching to have a look at the McLuhan Institute on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, and YouTube, because I'm using these different channels in different ways in order to further the work of the McLuhan Institute here. Yeah. I don't know if you've noticed that, but I'm
you've got lots of great stuff.
How I interact on those media.
Yeah, you've got lots of great stuff coming out all the time.
Thanks.
And furthermore, since you've politely neglected, I'll say you're also attempting to raise money to further these endeavors on Patreon.com. And you've got some funding goals that really need to be kept in order to keep the momentum going here, I'm sure. So, I mean, please.
Well, thanks for plugging that. I mean, honestly, there's so much work to do here. It's crazy. My current task, which is documenting and inventorying Eric McLuhan's library, I'm coming up to 500 books in, and I estimate about 6,000. And because I have a day job and a family with a wife and two small boys, you know, I take Tuesday nights to come out here and work on the books. You know, the work that I'm doing is at the moment funded basically through Patreon, and I've got 27 people now, I think, including yourself, Clinton. Thank you. Clinton recently re-upped and upped his donation from $1 a month to $5 a month, which I thank you. You know, like, I don't live pretty big, and that anybody puts a dollar a month toward helping me do what I do honestly means a lot. So I thank you for that. But honestly, there's more to do here in this work that I've described than one person can do in a lifetime. Marshall left a lot undone. He started a lot of things. My dad tied up a lot of loose ends. Laws of media, huge. Media and formal cause, theories of communication, the sensus communis. He he managed to accomplish a lot, which is really great. But again, there's still so much to do. And that's why I'm starting the McLuhan Institute. So, you know, it's a frustrating thing to see that there are a million things to do and you can maybe do a couple. But, you know, building these things takes time. I'm up to 700 people on the Facebook page, and I've done that in less than a year, and I think that's pretty good. But, you know, baby steps. The money I get from Patreon lets me spend a bit of time when I should be, you know, in the workshop or whatever. And I'm honestly grateful for every dollar. So, thanks.
So, thinking in terms of how McLuhan approached Time, Life, and Fortune magazine. If anybody wants to get into McLuhan, should they just hop on Wikipedia and read the Marshall McLuhan Wikipedia entry? Would that be a good foothold into the wild world of your father and grandfather's legacy here?
God, no. Wikipedia is a bit the worst place you can you can go. Don't get me started. I mean, Wikipedia is
what
great.
What do you don't get you started? We got 15 minutes left.
Do we?
We do.
Okay. Wikipedia. So, Wikipedia is a great place to turn for some quick, dirty information, but you know, it's real surface stuff, and you can't really you can't trust it, honestly. It's a good place to get a general idea, and then what you want to do is go check it out for yourself. So if you want to get some leads, sure, start at Wikipedia. But when somebody comes to me who doesn't know anything about Marshall McLuhan and wants to find out some stuff, I send them first to the Playboy interview. Mm-hmm. So Marshall did an interview with Playboy magazine that is really, really great. The author, whose name I should know, but I can't mention off the top of my head, managed to get a really good interview out of him, which wasn't easy to do because Marshall was very cagey and deliberate, and he was a very forceful personality. But the interviewer pressed him, and managed to pin him down on a few things. And it's a really good read. I mean, Marshall's never an easy read. He, as we've discussed, you know, used words very deliberately and didn't really give you an easy time of it, but it's worthwhile. The easiest places to encounter him are on YouTube. Look up Marshall McLuhan interviews. The lectures are amazing, but they're also more difficult. And then if you're interested from there, I'd start in on the books. And, you know, of course, understanding media is the Bible. But all the books are very interesting. And most of them are even overlooked. Cultures Are Business is a really cool book. Take Today, the Executive as Dropout, also a really cool book. And if you want to go back and see how Marshall deconstructed advertising in the 50s and 40s, check out The Mechanical Bride. Most of these things are pretty easily available. If you're interested in teaching and learning McLuhan methods, check out The City is Classroom, Understanding Language and Media, which is a really cool book. But I understand that's hard to get a hold of. If you go to the McLuhanInstitute.com, there's a panel there for our bookshop, and we sell copies of vintage McLuhan books. So if you see something there, and you know, if you're really into it and you can't afford it, let me know. We can work something out.
Awesome. That's wonderful, because advancing, it's hard enough to get people to read through whole books instead of reviews or summaries or whatnot. As you said, the problem is not specific to Wikipedia, but a surface understanding of a great many issues without approaching original texts doesn't give you enough to find the interface for the sort of interdisciplinary work, which it seems is really important in a field, in the field of field interpretation, you know. people.
Wikipedia. Mm-hmm. Sorry, to come back to Wikipedia for a second, an example of why I don't trust Wikipedia, or here's two examples. So there's a Wikipedia entry for the medium is the message. And you can always tell when somebody's read it because they just copy and paste the language. And it's not the greatest, easiest explanation of what Marshall meant. And years and years ago, under the belief that anybody can edit Wikipedia, I tried to do that, and I created a different entry using Marshall's words from different sources, different texts of his own in interviews, to explain what he meant, because he explained it so many different areas and ways. And, you know, shortly after I hit enter on it, it was taken down and the original put up, and I got this nasty message from the whatever overlord is in charge of that section of Wikipedia, saying that, you know, I didn't have authorization or standing to edit this and blah, blah, blah. And, you know, it just kind of soured me on it. And another time I got soured was, so I have a blog on medium.com under my own name, not for the Institute yet, Andrew McLuhan. I think it's medium.com/AndrewMcLuhan. And I wrote a sort of expository essay on the relation of Rachel Carson and Marshall McLuhan, because it's interesting that in 1962, The Silent Spring came out and sort of kicked off the environmental movement. Mm-hmm. And at that time, Marshall was working on Understanding Media, which came out in 64 and kind of kicked off a different kind of environmental movement, but not in the same way. I think Rachel Carson was a lot more effective in gaining popular momentum for what is now, you know, an environmental movement with Greenpeace and everybody's concern and global warming and all that stuff. Whereas the opposite, the study of our artificial environments, hasn't nearly grown the same kind of awareness and support, although it's just as serious an existential dilemma for us, really, as anybody who's looked into it knows. So I was, you know, it struck me to write a little bit of a essay exploring a comparison between Marshall McLuhan and Rachel Carson. Hmm. And in doing that, I looked up, I'll ask you to refer to the blog post because I don't remember exactly all the details, but I think I looked at media science, and there's no such thing on Wikipedia. And that tells you something about how people treat media study. And under media study, I found a couple things. And there was this one entry that maybe it was for Laws of Media or something. Anyway, it said Marshall and Eric McLuhan developed Laws of Media in 19 whatever. And then it said something about NBA 2K17 or something like that.
The video game.
Anyway, buried in that was a bullshit line referring to like a Nintendo game. And it was somebody's idea of a joke. And I just thought this was case in point how media studies aren't taken seriously by most people. You know, it's treated as a bit of a joke and not as a serious avenue of research. Mm-hmm. And so I pointed this out in the article. And the next time I checked, maybe it was even like a day later, it had been fixed. It had been changed. But at the time, the article hadn't been edited in like 8 years or something. So for that long, that egregious error or joke, really, it was somebody's intentional joke, had stood, mm-hmm. you know. And so that's why I don't really think that much about Wikipedia. As much as I applaud the effort and I find some value in it, I think it's dangerous for people to think. Like, I don't think most professors will allow you to use Wikipedia as a citation.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting.
And that's why I always tell people to go to primary sources.
Yes, yeah, it's interesting because, well, in getting into McLuhan, I've had to dive lots into older books from decades ago, centuries ago. One thing that's apparent to me is that an encyclopedia has never in history been supposed to be used as a primary source. They've always been this sort of cheater's guide, you know, a handy reference thing rather than anything authoritative, you know, if you look at, right? Yeah, it's interesting how in a mere few generations, the change in technology has so many people refer to Wikipedia as some sort of like, well, it's taken for granted, especially in mainstream media, where they just propagate this idea that everyone knows that you just have to look up anything on Wikipedia and it's all there, right? Or Google is the one-stop source for absolutely everything, right? It's marketing disguised as basic common sense on how to use what's actually an extremely much more powerful medium, right? One thing I'm trying to elaborate on is how we've gone from the command prompt from in the 70s and 80s straight to the Google search box with almost no change. Just becomes this magic, type of command, get an answer thing, and using a computer has been reduced to that for, you know, I'm sure the majority of people who own a phone anyway. It's interesting. Right. I'd like to mention, I've done a podcast episode a few episodes back with Donald Telford, who is a student in Arizona in a course of it's called Media Psychology is the name of the course. And
cool.
Media psychology as a topic he's learning is basically how to make the most addictive video games and movies as possible. Right, so what you're focusing on really is just the aspect of how, right, well, that's what's marketable. If a company wants to hire someone who knows media psychology, 99% of the time it's because they want eyeballs on their whatever they're doing on a computer screen, right? So that seems to be where the money is insofar as teaching media. Which is tragic.
Yeah, no, definitely. It's content stuff, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. It's nothing whatsoever.
And it's also... Well, the ethics of it are messed up. You know, that we're optimizing for, you know, addictiveness rather than, you know, other, let's say, more positive benefits.
So as awareness of this slot machine style of digital manipulation becomes more and more widespread, why is McLuhan the place people should be looking to get beneath the skin of their virtual or digital world?
Well, for me, it comes back to tools, right? So McLuhan is often held up as a quasi-mythical figure, as a guru, as a pop cult figure, which is great and everything, but he wasn't a magician, you know, he wasn't a prophet. He was somebody who was brilliant, enlightening quick, but he didn't have a crystal ball. He had a workshop of tools at his disposal, which he developed or he appropriated from Gestalt psychology or elsewhere in order to understand what was happening around us, what happened before us, and what might happen in the future. But again, he didn't do this through, you know, acts of magic. He did this through acts of work and understanding. So the reason to come to McLuhan, as far as I see it, is to understand his methods and try and use them for ourselves to help us, if only in our daily lives, to be a little more smart, you know? But really, it would be great if, you know, this was taught in schools and not just in humanities courses or in media study programs, but in engineering.
Sure.
The people who are designing these tools are the people who need to understand the power and what they're doing, because it's not harmless, you know?
No.
It's anything but harmless.
In
and I think I think they try to downplay that because if you understand the kind of power that's in your hands, quite literally, then there's responsibility, you know? And that's pretty heavy.
That's right. People are comfortable having corporations use their computer for them, but that's a form of surrender. Absolutely. Responsibility is really the name of the game here on an individual basis. If you're going to own a supercomputer, and I mean, in the 90s, the home computers were supercomputers compared to what preceded them. All right, that's the world that we're entering.
Yeah.
Well, entering. That's the world we entered 20 years ago. 30 years
ago. Exactly. It's the world we live in.
Yes, today.
Yeah.
Right? The present.
And, you know, the difference between a VLT, you know, one of these electronic lotto machines, and your smartphone is one of perception, because they can be equally destructive.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That's very poignant.
Not to get heavy.
No, you're absolutely right. And focusing, I mean, that is the task ahead of everyone and all of us in the information world. I mean, I grew up connected to the internet. I mean, I've seen hundreds of Wikipedia battles between different people in different fields fighting for control of information. So to have everyone, to have the greater world join on this participation adventure is it's a rough merging between the old internet and the new social media world kind of colliding together, and we're all witnessing it happen from our different private perspectives, all right? So thank you very much, Andrew McLuhan, for your insights into this world, which everyone, we are all, whether we know it or not, creating for ourselves or allowing corporations or other people to create for us to our own benefit or peril or what have you. Thank you for the guided tour of the magnificent, fantastic collection of books that you are weekly going through, slogging day by day, cataloging for the benefit of everyone else. I don't want that to be understated.
Thanks, Clinton. Thanks. It's good to talk to you.
Absolutely. I'll hope to have you on again. You've been listening to Life in the Foam. The home of this website is my new website, concernednetizen.com. That's concernednetizen.com. I figured it was time for a change of face, a bit of a fresher image, not the same nickname I used in high school on my Hotmail account 20 years ago. So, and you can find Andrew McLuhan at themcLuhanInstitute.com, full of great links to all of his various outlets and venues, and you can track his work live as he builds up the McLuhan Library. So thanks for joining us, and take care out there in digital wonderland.
Thanks, Clinton.